Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our exclusive interview with the chief executive of America's only producer of rare earth materials vital for the nation's security and economic prosperity. But first, joining me is Bill Greenwalt of the American Enterprise Institute, one of America's leading defense industrial minds, who, along with Dan Patt of the Hudson Institute, is the co-author of a new report out today, Competing in Time, Ensuring Capability Advantage and Mission Success Through Adaptable Resource Allocation. And of all people, Bill should know that because he is both a House appropriator and a Senate authorizer, served in the defense industry as well as in the Pentagon. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vago. I really appreciate being here.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. It's always an honor and pleasure. It's a great report. Okay, so all I have to do is just tell people it's 68 pages, and please take a look at it because I think it's an important report that gets to the heart of the problem, right? Bill, time is, as you and I have long discussed, is the most critical element, that the longer something takes, the more expensive it becomes and the more it obsolete it eventually is. Ash Carter, to his great credit, totally understood that as well. Would always make the case that the faster we can do things, the better. And America has a reputation of being able to move fast, right? In World War II, the Jeep was designed in 2 days. The atom bomb took 3 years. Ballistic missile submarines was five. Man on the moon was eight. And yet we've become where it just takes decades to execute programs. F-35 is still in the execution phase some 30 years after it was created. And the chief of staff of the Air Force is already talking about the need for maybe a new airplane. Why is time the most important factor from your perspective? And what's at stake if we don't start moving as fast as we need to move?
Time is critical and something that we have always done when the threat has been compelling. And your examples are right on target. World War II, 3 years and 9 months, and the amazing amounts of innovation we were able to accomplish. The beginnings of the Cold War, the same thing, creating brand new capabilities in less than 5 years. All of that seemed to have stopped beginning in the early 60s and moving on. And what we did in this study is go back and actually get the data and identify the time that is taken and basically establish a methodology for measuring time. And it's critical because as the threat becomes greater, and we're talking about 20-year cycles of innovation, there's just no way we can compete if our adversaries decide to and adopt more agile acquisition and resource allocation processes in the future.
What's at stake if we don't move faster, right? I mean, given how our adversaries are making, just to crystallize in people's minds the stakes.
The stakes are we're going to lose. The stakes are we will have capabilities being delivered and on the drawing board and just thought about when our adversaries have already produced 2, 3, 4 generations of a capability. And that is just critical. The other thing that's important is this is how the rest of the world and the rest of the commercial market innovates. They innovate in 1, 2, 3, 4 year time periods. 25-year innovation cycles are just not going to cut it from the Department of Defense, particularly when these commercial markets are driving the key technologies that the Department of Defense needs.
Look, you and I have been talking about this for years. You were the Pentagon Industrial Policy Chief. We were talking about speed 20 years ago when you were in the job. Ultimately, Bill, what has to happen, right? I mean, you've worked on all three corners of this iron triangle, on the industry piece of this, in Congress, and in the government. How do you move the cheese to get everybody to move faster? Because despite every effort to try to reform this, we're still not moving fast enough.
I don't think we have ever been scared enough. I don't think there's never been a sense of urgency yet. And perhaps we still don't have it. But the fact is that our technological dominance is eroding, and it may have eroded to the point where we are now behind. If that doesn't scare members of Congress, staff, the Pentagon, I don't know what will. So it's that compelling case, the compelling sense of urgency is the only thing that's going to break the other values that are right now drive the budget system, the requirement system, the acquisition system, the contracting system, all of the various things that we put in process and value, such as competition or cost or the price or making things perfectly predictable and executable when in fact is we can't predict anything. All those values are important, but could only be accomplished when you don't consider time and you don't consider urgency.
How do you change things on the industry side of it, right? On the one hand, you have some very, very innovative contractors that do want to change the world, for lack of a better word. Others have really monetized time, right? So the disposition is, as companies with a fiduciary responsibility to return value to their shareholders, you know, if they're getting paid 12% and they can drag something out for 20 years, all the better for them, and then end up getting a termination payment at the end of it. How do you change things on industry side of things? Because innovators sometimes have a hard time. They feel, you know, again, I mean, the valley of death problem, right? You may have a brilliant idea, but getting it from that to scale and in service is a lot of fatalities there.
Well, the idea of having agile budgeting, which this the conclusion of this report and recommendation to do, is essentially designed to allow for the going back and forth and funding multiple types of solutions to projects. And the money we're talking about is to meet the valley of death, is going from valley of death of, you know, right now we fund lots of $1 to $5 million projects, and then we either transition to a major defense program or not. But there is a lot of room for $25 to $50 to $75 million experimentation and prototype projects, which actually create real capabilities that our warfighters can use. And those are the areas where, for whatever reason, because of the PPBE process and because of the way we appropriate money, we do not fund those. And those are the areas that we need to be nimble, agile, and create the types of resource allocation funding mechanisms to fund those immediately.
Give me some of the other recommendations.
Sure.
In the report.
So there are really only three. Basically the fact is that time should be guiding many of our, if not all of our processes. But the first thing is do something quickly. Start immediately implementing pilot programs for resource allocation, whether they're mission budgeting, whether they're portfolio budgeting, whether they're looking at the way venture capitalists fund innovation. Those are the type of things that DoD should be doing now. Then what we say is let's get the best budgetary minds and innovation technologists together in a Packard Commission for our time, and look at how we should restructure the PPBE process and with it the acquisition and requirements process. And the third thing is to focus on what are our adversaries doing. Right now, it appears that they are incrementally, in a very, very fast way, mirroring what we used to do in the 50s and putting out capabilities. We need our intelligence community and analysts to start looking at what the Chinese are doing, what the Russians are doing, and why are they doing this faster, and then make those comparisons. Right now we're seeing a lot of anecdotes, but we need to make sure that this is indeed the case, which it looks like it is.
Recommend to folks to check out our interview with Steve Blank of Stanford University, legendary entrepreneur and master of the lean, or one of the originators of the lean startup methodology, who's going to be joining us for our strategy conversation on Saturday. And we cover some of this ground in that discussion. What's it going to take from a member of Congress standpoint to get them to change their mindset? You worked for a lot of legendary members of Congress. The last one you worked for was the late, great John McCain. As much of an innovator as he was, he also stopped a lot of programs from being killed. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, what has to change up on the Hill? Because many of these levers of power are on the Hill, right? 535 members in this board of directors, and they have a very powerful vote.
No, they do, and there is a lot that can be done, and frankly, I am actually optimistic, despite the divisions that we currently have. Members of Congress, senators, and representatives have a really, really tough job, and they are many of the ones that I've always been associated with it with. Have been open to education, open to new ideas, open to arguments that are based on sound analysis and data. And that's one of the reasons why Dan and I did this report, was to begin that educational process, to start working with decision makers, starting with the staff and working our way up to the members, to essentially establish the compelling case for change. There's no desire to make change just for change's sake. You have to have a real valid reason. And hopefully this report will provide the beginnings of that, not only that educational process, but the debate that is necessary to move us forward.
Let me ask you one last question. In order to make change means not doing things, right? It means killing programs. You're a student of history. What's the right way for us to go about doing it? Because it appears that this administration is talking a little bit about, you know, we're out of time. We have to make some of these big choices. Obviously, it's a lot easier when the president and the defense secretary gets behind it and uses their influence. What are some historical examples of how we can do this, how we can do big change and be successful at it?
Well, I'm not going to go into which programs should be effective or not, but whatever they do, they need to set aside a rather large pot of money that is flexible, that is able to pivot from different types of prototypes, experimentation, new capabilities. If they do not do that, if they basically slice and dice or kill one program and start another one on the same methodology that we have, we're not going to make it. We're going to need flexible budget allocation funding accounts, and those are what they really need to focus on. And frankly, I think they can do a lot more by establishing those than making changes to individual program accounts.
Bill, thanks so very much for joining us. Absolute honor and pleasure. Great to have you back on, and looking forward to having you back on more regularly to help drive some of these points home. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, Vago. I appreciate it.
And joining us now is Jim Litinsky, the founder, chairman, and CEO of MP Materials, the sole U.S. rare earths maker, a company that will feature prominently in President Biden's drive for national self-sufficiency. Jim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure. President Biden has just signed an executive order directing the government to study how to build national domestic capabilities for critical products, components, as well as resources to ensure no foreign power can undermine U.S. national security. One of those, obviously, are rare earths, which are critical to the production of everything from military avionics, commercial electronics, computer chips, clean energy, as well as a new generation of electric cars, right? I mean, demand is going to soar when it's not just Tesla, but it's General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and everybody doing that. China is the world's, 80% of the world's supply comes from China. And the Financial Times a week and a half ago reported that Beijing is considering cutting off supplies to the United States to undermine military programs, among them the F-35 Lightning II fighter. How does the executive order impact your guys' operation?
Yeah, great question. And obviously, very topical when we consider that right now our auto industry is shut down in many places because of a shortage of semiconductors. So I think as you hit the nail on the head, as we electrify and penetration goes from roughly 3% today to probably 90%+, and we add in drones, robots, wind turbines, any other defense technologies like the F-35, this is certainly a very critical supply chain issue and one of the big four that the president highlighted. And, we obviously, given that we've been on this mission for several years, greatly appreciate that and think it's warranted and important. But I think to your specific question, there's actually something important the audience should know to think about this problem, which is the rare earths are an upstream input. But when we think about, a Tesla or a GM electric vehicle, or an F-35 or any downstream product, ultimately the rare earths get made into magnets. And so we've got to get the full supply chain to the United States of America. And so if we could have all of the rare earths in the world, in the United States, we would still be shipping it all to China because that's where the downstream of the supply chain exists. And so what many people might not know is that we actually at MP Materials, we represent 15% of the global rare earth content already produced. The challenge is that the further downstream the supply chain is there. And so we are on a mission, and I think that this should be a mission for a number of us around the country, is to not only get more rare earth production domestically, but also continue to invest to move downstream so that we can have the magnet production here as well, so that we can have the full end-to-end solution, because obviously it doesn't do us any good if we're missing the middle.
So what is the kind of investment, Jim, that's going to be necessary, right? I mean, you hit the nail on the head. The neodymium magnets are actually made abroad, China and other countries. Obviously, the supplies are, in Africa and in Myanmar, or once upon a time known as Burma. How much investment on a national basis is required to establish this capability in the United States end to end?
There's a few important points on that. First, rare earth production, the rare earth mines are pretty much everywhere. If you've got rocks, you've got some amount of rare earth. The challenge is having enough rare earth to make it economic to process, certainly just in general, but also, mainly against China. And then from there, just actually put a data point on it. When we are done with our refining optimization project over the coming year, mining is really only going to be about 20% of our cost structure, or actually probably closer to 10%. It's about 20% today. The investment that is required to separate rare earths is quite substantial. So this is actually a problem of scale. It's not just, kind of putting, digging some holes in the ground. We've got to get the mines. Right. We've got to have ore bodies that are economic. But then beyond that, and it actually touches back to one thing from your prior question too, that I think is also important to contextualize, is that there's talk of, when we think about this supply chain, what if we are cut off? And actually the bigger question is what China has done today is actually longer term, even more challenging to us, which is that this industry, from rare earths to magnetics, has been utilized for an economic adversary to move downstream where the total dollars in GDP are, right? And so when we think about the cutoff is obviously a brought forward acute challenge, but what's happening today is even a bigger crisis just over the longer term, kind of like a frog in a boiling pot. We're talking about the auto industry, which is the single largest private employer in the country, 10 to 14 million jobs. And then when we think about, obviously, the climate change industries, as far as decarbonization, wind turbines, and many other things like flying taxis, who knows, robots, drones, all of these things, what we realize is actually the high value GDP products of tomorrow are going to be dominated by Chinese companies if we don't fully understand this supply chain. And in fact, you look at our capital markets today, there's several Chinese manufacturers that add up to, hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap, larger than GM. And so to solve this problem, just to answer your question, we've got to make the investments. And we at MP Materials are really leading the way here. We've got a site that's got, $2 billion of invested capital. And like I said, we're 15% of global content production. And as you know, we're a public company. We've got north of $500 million in cash on our balance sheet, no interest bearing debt. And we've committed to invest until we get this full supply chain here. But it's really going to require a lot of scale. Some small investments, some projects are nice, but at the end of the day, this is a scaled problem. I mean, the analogy would be, it's much closer to like the 5G Huawei problem than it is, let's make a bunch of small bets and, we can get some people in their garage to figure out how to have rare earth mines. And so this is really one of scale. To move a multi-billion dollar supply chain, it's going to require a lot of investment.
I want to get to the point about how we scale this, Jim, right? I mean, Congress has been futzing around with this for a long time. Molycorp, which you guys acquired and have been investing and building, was the company that used to do it, and it went out of business and it came back in. And Congress has been interested in making that investment to grow this national capability. Obviously, there is some dry powder on the street that's likely willing to invest in something which looks like a sure bet growth strategy. I'm not trying to pump your stock at all. Ticker symbol MP on the New York Stock Exchange, by the way. How much investment is necessary to do this, right? So, I mean, and what are the scaling problems, right? So if China tomorrow says, you guys can't have rare earths anymore, that then starts to become a very, very significant problem for the United States, right? How do you scale? How much flex do you have? And what kind of investment, right? If the U.S. government was to say, okay, end to end, this is a $5 billion investment, is that what's necessary to get you to where we need you to be? Or even bring other players in it, right? But I mean, at the end of the day, you guys are the one blazing this trail in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. So we are leading the way. And just for some background for those who remember the predecessor, we purchased, so I founded MP Materials in 2017 to purchase the bankrupt Molycorp assets. And at the time, the site was in care maintenance. It was shut down. It was actually days away from reclamation. My firm, we kicked in a couple $1 million just to keep the 8 people on site before they were going to lose their permit and literally shut it down. And so it was 8 people, it was care maintenance. Nobody believed that we could compete against China. And there was just sort of a lot of anger given the whole debacle that was Molycorp. We bought the site and we relaunched it. And the challenge with a relaunch and the challenge with this industry in general is that because this entire supply chain exists in China, to do this properly takes time and resources, as we've said. The American companies, so the Teslas, GMs, Fords of the world, they buy all of their magnets in China. And so we have to compete. We have to provide them an alternative. It's no different than the semiconductor issue. Obviously, it's different. We're not semiconductors, but it is a similar concept, which is we've got to be able to provide them a value add product at a reasonable price. The good news is at MP, we are profitable. We have a significant margin uplift opportunity as we continue to move downstream and refine. As far as specific investment, our next major step, our stage 3, will be figuring out how to get domestic magnet production. And we've got a team working on that today. We've got, engineers and business people working in parallel with our stage 2 team to get that capability in the United States. And, our ultimate customers, what's unfortunate is today, the product that we ship overseas to China, that's being bought by American companies. It's right. being sent over there to be processed. And so what we need to do is figure out, instead of having to ship it there, to get this whole solution to them. And I think they can be part of that solution. But more importantly, we shouldn't expect American companies to accept a substandard economic solution. I believe what we should do, and I think this is where the president's executive order and where everyone in DC can really be of a big help. And this is not an MP Materials issue. This is a industry writ large issue to solve this supply chain problem. Is let's create the economic incentives for domestic industry to want this supply chain here, right? So for example, if we're gonna have a $7,500 tax credit for an electric vehicle, well, why don't we figure out a way to actually, harness some of those tax incentives to make sure that supply chain is here? There's various ways. There was a bill introduced, the RARE Act in the Senate and the OR Act in the House, that was bipartisan. That have tax multipliers. And so the concept is we need to actually create that, carrot, if you will, opportunity for industry to want this supply chain here. And then I think the capital markets, Wall Street will do the rest.
So seeing as how this is Washington and everybody wants to quantify everything, I guess what you're saying is that this is an ecosystem-wide issue, right? It's not a very easy number that, hey, if we spend $1 billion, $500 million, to solve, it's not that easy. It's a much, much bigger problem. It's about replicating an entire ecosystem that exists in China for the finished products, right? Those magnets that go into the motors, that go into the Teslas and the wind turbines, et cetera.
That's exactly it, right? There's unfortunately no way to put a number on it where you can say, oh, it's just X, because it depends on what share of the industry. As you said perfectly, there's a whole ecosystem involved here. And the concept is that we need to take a significant chunk of share of a supply chain and get it here on shore so that we then have the diversity and reliability. And so, unfortunately, it's not just about, hey, let's build this one facility and then problem solve, because the goal is ultimately to provide a diverse, reliable supply chain for industry.
And so, and I don't mean to say this to butter your guys' toast, right? So for years, people have been saying the supply chain will never come back. And so one of the things that you guys were doing is to try to create that supply chain. So I guess your message to everybody would be, bring that supply chain back.
Right. I think we're a sort of a fair role model, if I may say, of kind of what we need more of, which is, you know, we started at the very upstream and we recognized that this was sort of a multi-stage challenge. And we've been pragmatic about each step of the way and bringing in the right resources and talent that are required. And, you know, unfortunately, this can't be done overnight. But if we can create the right incentives for other entrepreneurs like us to do this, I think we can really make some progress on this problem. It's not that the supply chain isn't coming back. It's that we need to, it's a long-term challenge to get it back. And so it's not an overnight fix. And so we've got to start way upstream and then continue to move downstream. So if you look at MP, that's what we've done, right? Our first stage was making a concentrated product. Our second stage is making a refined product. And then our third stage will be making the actual magnets. And then we can talk about recycling and whatnot beyond that. But that is a multi-stage effort that will take a long period of time and cannot just be done simply overnight. I mean, unless we have an unlimited checkbook for all companies.
Jim, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Best of luck. And I guess I should tell the audience, right? So at the very top, you said you were keeping 8 people on in an abandoned facility that was about to be reclaimed. And now you have 300 people working for you?
That's right. We're hiring another 200 over the coming year. And we're creating about 1,000 construction jobs this year. And, you know, I think that this is hopefully a microcosm of a much, you know, a one example of many examples in the coming years of what we can do.
And I should also point out, you're doing it with some of the strictest environmental laws in the country, in the golden, great state of California. Thanks so much again. Best of luck to you. And look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it. And talk to you soon.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.